so much older then, I'm younger than that now.
Hello and welcome into Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton. Today you'll meet the inspiring woman who has exploded onto the Masters sports track and field scene at the age of 50 after becoming a first-time mother in her 40s. And we're going to take a deep dive into food politics and the powerful corporate interests that are making us sick. In fact, a study published in the journal Nature Food found that while the youngest children in the U.S. have healthy diets, by age 10, they have the least healthy diets in the entire world. And the quality of the U.S. diet doesn't return to even global averages until age 45 or 50. And the factor in this decades-long poor diet is ultra-processed foods. What can we do to fight those who put corporate profit above public health? This is Growing Bolder. Well, if you're like me and really just about every human being who cares about what we put into our bodies and what we feed our children and our grandchildren, then you are constantly frustrated by the never-ending conflicting opinions and changing recommendations on how we should be eating. You're upset about the lack of transparency and regulation over what's in the food that we eat and how it's processed. You don't trust the food system anymore because we live in a time and in a place in which corporate health is now more important than public health, a time in which politics and not science and certainly not common sense is driving national decision-making processes over every aspect of what we eat. So the question is, what are we to do? Well, there is one person who may be more qualified than anyone to answer that question. Marion Nessel is a renowned nutrition expert who understands the intersection of food, money, and power. And for more than five decades now, she has challenged the status quo. She's called out the inefficiencies and the injustices of our agriculture and food production industries. She is a professor emerita at New York University, a visiting professor of nutritional sciences at Cornell. She holds a PhD in molecular biology and a master's in public health from Cal Berkeley. She's the author of 16 books, including the landmark Food Politics, revealing for the first time how the food industry uses lobbying, public relations, and advertising to promote products and policies that actually undermine public health. She also wrote the best-selling What to Eat book back in 2006, and she's just released What to Eat Now, totally revised, updated, a field guide to the supermarket. She's won far too many awards to mention, so let's just get with it as we welcome Marion Nessel. Marion, how you doing today?
I'm doing just fine. Thanks for having me here.
Well, thank you for all you do and for continuing to do what you do. And you know, in truth, there's so many problems and so many issues. I'm not sure where to start. So let me just ask you this. What do you think is the biggest, most pressing concern today about how our food is grown, produced, or consumed?
Well, we have a food production system that produces feed for animals and fuel for automobiles and isn't focused on food for people at all. I think we need to completely change that.
You know, it is amazing. Very obvious that the agricultural movement in the U.S. is not at all aligned with the health and well-being movement. Has there always been this disconnect? And do you have any hope that one day they might be aligned?
I think it's always been disconnected. But what's happened to the food system is absolutely amazing. If you look at the statistics for corn and soybeans, we grow a lot of corn and soybeans in the United States. Nearly half of them are used as feed for animals. Okay, we eat animals. But the other half is used for fuel for automobiles or diesel fuel for airplanes. I mean, this makes no sense at all. Only a tiny percentage of corn and soybeans are used as food for people. So this is a system of industrial agricultural production that has nothing to do with public health. You know, we have big public health problems in the United States, of which by far the largest is that people eat too much and are overweight or obese. Nearly 75% of American adults are overweight or obese. That's the great majority. That means most people are eating too much, and eating too much of the wrong kinds of foods, obviously, which is why they're overweight. And we don't have a healthcare system in this country, if you haven't noticed that lately. And I think we need to change that. If only we could.
Exactly. I mean, the problem is overwhelming. You mentioned corn and soybeans, and a lot of what we eat. We eat too much of it, but a lot of what we eat is ultra-processed. It's got chemicals in it. Can we talk about organics for just a moment? Because sure. they were really nowhere to be found, you know, for the most people a couple of decades ago. Certainly in 2006 when you wrote your book about what to eat.
I had to look hard for them.
Yeah, and now they're everywhere. In fact, you call organics the Cinderella step food of the food system. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, it's regulated, and I'm a big proponent of organics. It's a production value, and the foods are produced without pesticides or without the most harmful pesticides, no sewage sludge. That turned out to be really important, and no GMOs, which matters or doesn't matter, depending on how you feel about that kind of system. And producers are inspected to make sure that they follow those rules. And to a very large part, organic producers are trying to put back into the soil what they take out of the soil. So they are working on regenerative principles, even if they're not calling it that. So I'm greatly in favor of organics. The system has flaws, but by and large, it's a big step forward. I don't want all those pesticides in my food.
And you believe that the Department of Agriculture having oversight, creating the organic standards, is actually a conflict of interest.
Oh, absolutely. Because the Department of Agriculture's purpose is to promote industrial agriculture, and they do that really, really well in lots of ways, with subsidies and with checkoff programs that in which the Department of Agriculture essentially sponsors and oversees marketing campaigns for industrial commodities. And for organics, there are tokens in the farm bill. I mean, nothing really significant. I think, you know, this requires a major overhaul. The new administration has been talking a lot about pesticides in the food supply. I can't wait to see what they're going to do about them.
So far, not much, huh?
Not much.
And, you know, another problem, I think, and I know that you've written about this, is that junk food is subsidized. You know, commodity food production is subsidized where organics are not, which makes them more expensive, more difficult, almost unattainable for poor people to consume.
Yeah, I mean, there are two things going on here. One is the unfairness of our food system, because of its focus on industrial agriculture, the sort of philosophy behind it is the poor need calories, give the poor calories, never mind where the calories come from. And that organics are an inherent critique of industrial agricultural productions. And the Department of Agriculture wants to make sure that nobody thinks that organics are better. That's where the conflicts of interest come in, because organics are better. That's why they cost more, because more work has gone into producing them. This is a system that needs system change. System change is very difficult. The one big change that's happened over the last 20 years is that there's more and more interest in organic. There's more organic production. You know, I did a tour of Manhattan supermarkets from some of the most expensive areas in the city to some of the poorest areas in the city. And even the supermarkets in the poorest areas were carrying organics, and not at prices that were any different from anywhere else in the city. So I thought that was good. But the inequalities in income in our country make it impossible for poor people to buy these kinds of things, because they're having enough trouble paying for food. Supermarket prices are up. one of the things that the two editions of the book make clear is that prices have doubled in 20 years. Doubled. That's a lot. A lot of that doubling came since the pandemic. But, you know, we need to do something about that and make it possible for poor people to eat. And what's happening to SNAP benefits, food stamp benefits, isn't helping at all.
And while the cost of groceries overall has risen, is it not true that the cost of fresh produce, organic foods, has risen more than the ultra-processed food, which again makes it something that poor people end up having to buy?
Yeah, it's not a fair system in any way whatsoever. And the Department of Commerce keeps data on these kinds of things. And these data show that the cost of all foods has gone up, but the cost of healthier foods has gone up more than the cost of unhealthier foods. Oh, great.
Hey, before we leave organics, one more question, because, I don't think there's any question people don't want to have pesticides and herbicides and insecticides in their food. But just because something says organic doesn't mean it's good for you, right? I mean, there's still ultra processed organic food, is there not?
Yeah, organic junk food is still junk food, is the way I like to put it. The organic movement originally didn't want to have organic junk foods, but, you know, there's a lot of money at stake here. And like everything else in the food system, money talks.
You know, you touched on chemicals in our food supply, pesticides, herbicides, insecticides, fertilizers, still widely used, still polluting the environment, still in our food. And as I understand it, in our bodies, I read recently that glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, classified as a possible human carcinogen, is literally in the bloodstream of just about everyone, yet products containing glyphosate remain on the market. Product labels have not changed. What kind of proof does the EPA or the FDA need to be proactive in protecting our health from these kinds of things?
Well, the EPA needs politics, and it doesn't have it, or has a different kind of politics. The question is whether you prioritize public health or whether you prioritize corporate health. And corporations pay for election campaigns. That's the way the system works. You know, if we're going to change the food system, the first thing we have to do is get money out of politics. Good luck with that, but worth working toward.
Well, and it's not only getting the chemicals out of our food. I think one of the problems are the pollutants in the air, especially the emissions from coal-burning power plants that contaminate the water supply and the soil. Why doesn't the EPA do more about that?
Good question. Because when it did, it got overruled. The politics of coal burning power plants are that presidents and administrations for decades have tried to get the coal burning power plants to clean up their emissions, put filters in, do whatever it takes to keep the toxic chemicals, particularly mercury, from getting into the atmosphere. And whenever there are moves to do that, the chemical industry comes in and the coal-burning power plant industry comes in and flexes its muscles and everybody caves. And now we have an EPA that is backing off on a lot of these things, despite the Make America Healthy Again movement, which is very powerful in this current administration. And which initially said right from the beginning that it wanted to do something about mercury in fish. If you want to do something about mercury in fish, you've got to turn off coal-burning power plants. You know, I don't see any signs of that.
They talk a good talk, but so far they're not walking the walk. I think those who are RFK backers love the fact that he seems to be concerned about chemicals in our food system, but yet hasn't really done anything, has he?
No, I think he's come up against lobbying in the way that everybody in government comes up against lobbying. And we have a government that's captured by corporations. So to expect the government to be able to resist corporate pressures is asking a lot. And in this particular government, it doesn't make any sense to even raise the question. You know, I'm fascinated by what's going on with RFK Jr. and the MAHA movement, because I agree with a lot of the goals of the MAHA movement. And I'm really glad that they're making a fuss about those goals. But I want to see some action. And the second MAHA report, which is the report about strategies, mentioned the word regulation only in the context of the FDA's generally recognized the SAFE program, asking it to be a little bit more restrictive about what it allows as chemicals in the food supply. That was the only place where regulation was even mentioned. Everything else was explore, examine, let's look at, let's consider, let's think about, you know, I mean, come on, everybody. You've got the power. Use it. But I think what happened is they ran up against lobbying. And the there's quite a bit of evidence that after there were meetings with agricultural producers who said, really, you're going to take glyphosate away from us? Are you out of your mind? We won't be able to produce our crops. Actually, they can, but they don't want to. You know, there would hurt them, and they don't want to be hurt. I can understand that. And they've been subsidized for decades. Once you get subsidized, you don't want to lose them.
That is Marion Nestle, the author of 16 books, including the best-selling 2006 hit, What to Eat. When we return, she talks about her new book, 20 years later, What to Eat Now. This is Growing Bolder. Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram for our latest stories, reels, and motivational memes. Welcome back to Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton. We are speaking today with Marion Nestle, an icon in the public health space who has written 16 books about the food industry and how it actually undermines public health through lobbying, public relations, and advertising. Let's now rejoin our conversation as I ask if food politics is now too strong and our system too broken to ever be able to overcome corporate interest.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it depends a lot on who gets elected. When, you know, I deal with young people, and they, particularly young people who are interested in food, and they want to change the world through food. That's exciting. And I want to cheer them on. And when they say, what can they do? I say, run for office. You know, get, you want power, get you a power to change the system. To get power, you've got to run for office. And the last election cycle showed that it's possible for people who have principles and care about public health to win elections. That should be a big incentive.
It seems like social media, as it is in so many different things, is making this far more challenging because, you know, it's obvious the people who run social media want to keep us on their platforms by feeding us, if you will, you know, more of what we want to hear. And so no matter what you believe, I mean, if you want to believe that eating nothing but raw red meat is good for you, I'm certain you can find someone online that's going to reinforce that belief. Are you concerned about the impact of social media on all of these issues we're talking about?
Well, I'm just terrified about it, in part because there's a deep fake ad for a product that I would never endorse that's floating around on the internet. It looks just like me. It sounds just like me, but it's not me. And my new book, What to Eat Now, which has just come out, has two fake books that are listed on Amazon, one with exactly the same cover, but a different author, and the other one with a different cover that's a workbook. That has absolutely no content in it that has anything to do with my book. You know, I mean, these kinds of things are all over the place, and there's nothing that can be done about them, I've been told. Relax and enjoy it. There's nothing you can do about it. So I think we need to be teaching everybody about media literacy, about how to tell the difference between real and fake. it's very difficult. I got caught. I almost got caught by a really amazing scam not too long ago. And, you know, I'm a pretty skeptical person. I couldn't believe I got caught up in this thing. But it was a scam that was organized in such a way that somebody I trusted was the one who was offering it. And at every juncture where I questioned it, that person said, oh, no, this is legit.
Hmm.
And the scam was so horrible and came from such an unrespectable person that I politely declined the whole thing. It was a good thing. I have a little integrity because it really saved me.
Can you tell us any more about it? I'm curious what the scam was.
Oh, it was somebody offering. It was somebody who had heard me on a podcast and was so impressed by what I said that he wanted to support my work. He was an extraordinarily wealthy businessman who pretended to be Changpeng Zhou, who was the Bitcoin guy who was just pardoned by Trump. And the podcast that I had been on that pretended to be the scam included the head of this, the host of this podcast, as the person saying this was completely legitimate. And I didn't have an email for the podcaster, so I couldn't get back to him to find out whether this was really him. And when I finally was able to track down one of his staff people, they assured me that this guy has been used in so many scams that they've made a video of it.
Wow.
And they sent me the video and showed all the ways in which this guy was being used to scam people when it had nothing to do with him.
Not only is it sophisticated, it's new stuff that we haven't seen before. So it's,
and we don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah, not like you can kind of steel yourself against it. Let's talk a bit more about your new book, What to Eat Now. Needed, because there are so many foods on supermarket shelves that weren't on the shelves when you first published it. Other than organics, what's changed in the supermarket for better or for worse when it comes to products?
Well, I would say one really terrific change is the substitution of bottled waters for full sugar Coke and Pepsi. You know, I'm not in favor of bottled water. I think I'm in favor of tap water for two reasons. It doesn't pollute the world with plastic. Three reasons. It's cheaper. And if everybody consumed tap water, they would make sure that the tap water supplies were safe and being monitored carefully. And I actually visited a water treatment plant to see what was going on with it, and I was very impressed. I'm a tap water aficionado. I live in New York. It's got a great tap water supply. But I think that bottled waters are, even if they're fruit flavored, even if they've got a little alcohol in them, and even if they have a little cannabis in them, which they do, are still better than full sugar sodas. So that's a big change. Online ordering is an enormous change, and it has changed the way that supermarkets operate. It's caused their complete reorganization. They get a quite significant proportion of their income from online orders of one kind or another. They've had to contract with delivery services or arrange for pickups. That's a big one. Plant-based, you know, the only plant-based milk that existed 20 years ago was soy milk. Now you can get any plant you can think of. There's a milk made out of it, and some of them are really good. I think they're products that stand on their own, and really, I like the macadamia nut milk. Yum. It's really pretty good. And some of the others are too. Some of them are chalky. I don't know. You have to find the ones you like. But those are big changes. The introduction of international foods into all parts of the supermarket is new. And I thought that was a welcome change that recognizes the diversity of dietary preferences in our society. But the main things, the way supermarkets sell food, their objective to get you to do as much impulse buying as possible, the slotting fees, all that stuff is still the same.
Slotting fees are the one-time upfront fees that are charged by retailers to manufacturers to secure shelf space for new products. And for a single product, a national rollout at a major retail chain can cost up to $3 million in upfront slotting fees. So for a small product line of just four items, costs can reach $16 million in 1 year for full national supermarket coverage, which creates a significant barrier for any small producer. We're back with more from Arian Nessel. This is Growing Bolder.
Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts.
Welcome back to Growing Bolder as we wrap up our conversation with Arian Nessel, a food scientist with a master's in public health and a PhD in molecular biology, who writes about food politics and the impact of corporate lobbying on what we eat every day. And after many decades battling on behalf of public health, Nessel is still fighting the good fight, and you might be surprised to learn just how old she is. I mentioned that you've written 16 books. I know you've got another one coming out soon. What I have not mentioned, Arian Nessel, is your age.
Well,
you know what? It's hard to escape, isn't it? Because you read about you, and the media can't resist. And I stopped resisting because it's important to the people that we talk to know that we can keep on keeping on. We can continue to make ripples in this world, no matter how old we are. You are 89 years old. You will be 90 before too long. All 16 books that you have written, you wrote after the age of 50.
After the age of 66.
My goodness, what keeps you going?
I don't know. I'm having a really good time. I did a memoir a couple of years ago. It's called Slow Cooked, An Unexpected Life in Food Politics. And I tell the story in that memoir of how long it took me to be able to find what I liked doing and land in a position where I was able to do it. I mean, I think I was extremely fortunate to find that out, even though I was in my 60s when I started writing about food politics in a really serious way. And it's been, it's been a great ride. That's all I can say. NYU turned out to be the perfect place for me. I was able to, I was a full professor with tenure. I couldn't be touched. I had a safe job and a university that supported what I did. I didn't need a lot of grant money. What I needed was right here. And that's been terrific. That was really lucky. And so I turn out I like writing books. I like having big projects to do. I like taking tons of information and boiling it down in ways that people can understand. I really enjoy doing that. And people tell me I have impact. I have no way of assessing the kind of impact that I have. But I'm told there's impact.
Well, forgive me, Miriam, for looking over your shoulder behind you, but I can't help but notice that there is a box of sugary sweet ultra-processed cereal on your desk. And I know there's got to be a reason for that. Did that have something to do with your next book?
It has everything to do with my next book. My next book is called Sugar Coated, and it's a book about the history of nutrition policy and culture in the United States, written with a colleague, Lisa Sutherland, and it uses cereal boxes as illustrations. It'll be published by University of California Press in 2026, about in a year from now. And Kellogg offered this, and I thought, oh, I really have to have it. And I was very disappointed because the box came without any cereal in it. So it's an ad. It's not a box of cereal, unfortunately.
We will certainly look forward to that book. Let me ask you, what do you eat? Knowing what you know, what does your diet look like? When do you eat and what do you eat?
Well, I follow my own dietary recommendations. I have no trouble following them. Easily summarized by Michael Pollan in 7 words, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. I took 700 pages to say the same thing. That's how I eat. I mean, I'm lucky. I like vegetables. For breakfast, I have an unsweetened, unsalted cereal, whole grain with fruit. I add my own sugar. I like sugar. I add my own sugar. I just don't add much. For lunch, I'll have salad or a sandwich. For dinner, I'll have salad or, something small. At my advanced age, we don't eat much anymore, unfortunately.
Huh. And tell me about, what a pleasure to talk to someone just about to turn 90 who is as vibrant, active as you are. We hear about our cognitive decline as we get older and ways to keep that. Obviously, you keep your mind working. Are you as productive, maybe in a different way, as you ever have been? Are you as curious? Are you as creative? Are you as talented? How has aging impacted your ability to do what you want to do?
The usual aches and pains that come with age. I do a lot of physical therapy. It helps a lot. But I think that having a project to work on is enormously helpful. I'm always thinking about the project. I'm always reading new material. The blog also ties me to whatever is happening because I have 5 posts a week and I do them on weekends. And so that's sort of a weekend project. It doesn't take very long to do because I've accumulated things during the week that I'm going to be writing about. But it forces me to keep up. It forces me to stay engaged. And I like that. I mean, it works for me. So I'm not just thinking about the aches and pains, which I think happens if you don't have a lot of other things to do. You spend a lot of time thinking about that. I try to avoid going to doctors. Fortunately, I've got a great one who gets back to me whenever anything needs discussion. But I have other things to think about. And that seemed to me to be more interesting than aches and pains.
And the nature of what you do, Miriam, requires that you interact in a meaningful way with, I'm guessing, other generations, publishers, co-writers. Tell us about the benefit of staying socially engaged, intellectually connected to others.
Well, it's really important for me. I mean, I'm in my office in NYU. I was fortunate enough to be able to keep the office after retirement. That's quite unusual. And part of the reason for it is that our department, for complicated reasons, is in excessive rented space. There are a lot of empty offices. So, and that means there are people around that I can talk to. There's students who are coming in. There are students who are very helpful. One of them came in yesterday and helped me with social media because that's not something I know how to do very easily. And I think there are enormous benefits. I really want to know what young people think about these kinds of issues because they have very different ways of thinking about it than I do. And some of the ways are quite startling. For example, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, I could not in any of my lectures talk about capitalism. Because people would get very uncomfortable and squirmy and think, oh, she's a Marxist. Now, when I talk about corporate control of government, captured government, government that's more concerned about corporations than people, someone in the audience will always say, aren't you talking about capitalism? That's a big change. And I think it's a very important one. In my experience, young people get the politics in ways that generations before them did not get it. They see it loud and clear, in part because their futures are so insecure. When I graduated college, and I'm fond of saying, at Berkeley, my tuition was $32 a semester.
Wow.
Think about that. And you could, if you had an income of $100 a month, when I was a student, you were doing great. You could afford to live in a really nice place. You could afford to eat out. You could afford to do all kinds of things. The world has changed in ways that are not good for young people. And they see that. They see it loud and clear, and they understand that it's not them. It's the system. And so I think that the introduction of systems thinking has been very, very powerful, and it's very important. And if we're going to change the system, everybody's got to understand what it's about.
You know, one of the things about growing older, I think, is that many of us, for lack of a better word, Miriam, become more revolutionary. You know, I mean, if not now, when? You've always been willing to take a stance, to call out waste, to call out corruption, to call out inefficiencies. Do you feel maybe a little more radical now than ever? Do you want to start a revolution? Have you started a revolution? Are you doing that?
Well, I wish I could. I think younger people have to do it. I mean, I don't think I can do it. And in any case, one person cannot do it. One person can only do what one person can do. If you want to start a revolution, you got to get lots of people behind you. And you've got to get out and do community organizing. You've got to do door-to-door canvassing. You've got to convince everybody that you know that they need to work towards a common goal that's going to be good for everybody. But that's not something I can do. I write books. I write a blog. I give talks. That's what I do. That, I discovered, was pretty much what I can do as an individual. Beyond that, I try to support organizations that I think are doing good work. You know, when I was younger, I joined those organizations and did things, but I'm not doing that anymore.
So let's take this back to where we began, you know, with all of the problems with food production, the politics of food, if you will. What you're saying is that if we want to change it, voting with our fork is not enough. We've got to do more than just choose what we eat. We've got to bound together to affect the kind of change that you think we need.
Yeah, I call it voting with your vote. I think voting with forks is very important because it puts pressure on food companies. And there are examples in which voting with your fork has been very effective in, well, organics, for example, are a really good example. People buy organics, then more organics will be produced. But the voting with the vote is crucial. And politics is ugly these days. And young people tell me that they don't want to have anything to do with it because it's so ugly. But I think everybody has to get involved in politics if we're going to make any kind of meaningful change. And there are different ways of getting involved in politics. You can get involved in local politics. Those are easier and cleaner. Get on your local school board. Get on your local water board. Get on your local whatever. And you'll be in a position to have power over that particular area. I think schools are a terrific place to start. Because if you change the food in a school, you're improving the lives of every child in that school. That's a meaningful thing to do. And some schools are easier to make changes in than others. There's no question about that. But it's worth trying. And if you don't do it, who's going to do it? I mean, that's why I think everybody needs to be involved in these things. And I would say, to be realistic, find a way of being politically active that's comfortable for you. You don't have to be miserably uncomfortable. You don't have to be out on picket lines if you don't want to be out on a picket line. But find a way to do it. My way is to write. It's to write a daily blog. It's to write books. It's to give lectures. It's to talk on podcasts. You know, I mean, that's my way of doing it. But there are other ways. And find a way that works for you. Write letters to editors. Call your congressman. Do those things. Do something.
Speaking of your influence, is it true that you have been voted the number two foodie influencer in America behind only Michelle Obama?
Oh, yeah, that was Mark Bittman. Thank you, Mark. That was really nice of you. Oh, yeah, that was very nice of him.
Well, you know, folks, read her book. I'm one final question for you, Marion, if we can. You know, what's the takeaway of this story? What's the moral of life in general? And you can take food production out of it altogether if you want. What have you learned in your nearly 90 years about what makes a good life that you wish others knew?
Well, food is one of life's greatest pleasures. And it's a way to address the most important problems in society. I can hardly think of a major societal problem that doesn't involve food in some critically important way. So food choices matter. Vote with your fork. Vote with your vote. Use it and get pleasure out of it. It's the pleasure part of it that makes it so much fun.
Our thanks to Marion Nessel, and not just for her time, but for what she's done on our behalf for decades, and also for her inspiring example of growing bolder. If you'd like to learn more about Marion and about her new book, What to Eat Now, just check her out at foodpolitics.com.
Embrace the health and longevity movement with the Fountain of Youth monthly e-newsletter. Growing Boulder and the National Senior Games Association have teamed up to bring you the latest videos, podcasts, and articles on inspirational masters athletes and the many benefits of physical activity delivered right to your inbox. Just go to nsga.com/connect to sign up for free today. The Fountain of Youth, because if you want to keep moving, you have to keep moving.
Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram for our latest stories, reels, and motivational memes. Welcome back to Growing Bolder. One of the highlights of the 2025 National Senior Games in Des Moines, Iowa, was the return of Des Moines native Christy Matthews. Christy was a high school track star decades ago, but she didn't run it off for 30 years until she turned 50, and then she turned heads, setting world records and inspiring others to get off the couch. Christy Matthews is the fastest women's 400-meter runner over the age of 50 in history. But this meet is different. This is a homecoming for Matthews.
Lane number 6 from California, Christy Matthews.
An Iowa native, she ran her first race here before becoming a 3-time high school track state champion. These National Senior Games are not about times, medals, or records. These games are about family and friends.
This has got to be the highlight of my track career, to be honest with you. It's great being back home. It's great seeing everyone out here. Just the atmosphere is wonderful. And I'm just so appreciative to be a part of this.
You're not just a part of it. I mean, you're a major inspiration. That's got to feel good to you to know that you're inspiring older adults who maybe never thought about getting off the couch.
I hope so. I mean, that's the whole point, right? You can dream it. You can do it, you know, and I definitely want to be an inspiration for that. I want to be an inspiration for myself, too. It keeps me going. You know, one of the things I always tell myself before I run and after I run is remember my why. I have to remember why I'm doing this. And it can be different for anyone. But for me, it's because I want to stay healthy. I want to stay fit and I want to keep enjoying life. So that's my why. And I just want everyone to remember theirs, too.
Matthew's commitment to her health is rooted in her love for her daughter, Chriselle. After college, Matthews stepped away from the track for 3 decades. But after having her daughter in her mid-40s, Christy's desire to be a healthy mom led her first to soccer and then back to running at age 50. she exploded onto the Masters track scene, setting world and American age group records in the 400, winning national titles in the 100, 200, 400, and 800, and earning USA Track and Field's 2024 Masters Female Sprint Athlete of the Year honor.
It's just amazing because I remember when she started running, and that's because we had a fraternity, and she came out to run with us and the guys, and she could run with all of us, and that was when she was like, you know, 9 or 10 years old, and that's, she's just been incredible ever since then. So
it was a father-son run. Yeah. And he didn't have a boy at that time, so Christy said, I'll go run with you, Dad, and she won.
Yeah, it was great.
She beat all the older guys, and after the race, I told her, Dad, that girl is a good runner. And so, you know, a few years went by, and was able to get with her and help her in getting ready for her state meet.
It's nothing like coming home for everybody. Mm-hmm. That's where it all started. Her roots are here in Iowa.
In Des Moines, Matthews won her age group titles in 5 races, setting meet records in the 400 and 800 meters, and was a relay champion in the 4x100, inspiring her daughter to dream big dreams as she watched her mom run.
I feel really, like, happy and proud of her, and I'm proud of myself for trying to practice to be just like her. And I also feel heartwarmed when I just think about it, and I want to be like her, like I didn't write this for nothing. And I'm just so glad that she's my mom, and yeah.
And our first place finisher under 1 minute.
For Christy, racing is more than earning medals and fast times.
That's just a supportive environment, and I'm just glad I could come out here and represent my family and the state and really all of the athletes. All of us are champions being out here. I mean, we show up. We're not getting paid for this. This is all heart and soul, and each one of us puts in the same amount of energy, the same amount of effort, and, you know, we're just out here living life and having a good time, and I think we all should be applauded for coming out. The thing I like about Senior Games is that it helps us to keep going. You know, life isn't over. We might be older, but we're not old. We can still do this.
We can still do this. A simple but powerful reminder that we are not limited by our age. We are limited by what we tell ourselves. We participate in our own aging when we tell ourselves stories. I'm too old to learn this. At my age, this is normal. What do you expect? I'm not young anymore. Over time, these stories that we tell ourselves actually become personal rules. We can't stop time. We can stop surrendering to it prematurely. Many age-related declines are amplified and sometimes even triggered by expectation rather than biology alone. What the mind believes, the body embraces. We'll see you next time.
The Growing Boulder Radio Show is a production of Growing Boulder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Boulder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, flowing high and mighty trapped. Countless fire and flaming road, using ideas as my maps. We'll meet on edges soon, said I, proud neath heated brow. So much older than I'm younger than that now. Half right prejudice leap before, rip down all hate I scream. Lies that life is black and white, spoke from my skull I dream. Romantic flanks of musketeers, foundation deep. So much older than I'm younger than that now. In So much older then, I'm younger than that now.
Deceived me into thinking I had something to protect. Good and bad, I defined these terms quite clear, no doubt, somehow.
But I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now.